Now, today I'd like to do two things. First of all, I'd like to share with you some basic principles on how to prepare or how to rear a good marriage partner. And then I hope at the end we'll have a good slice of time for some questions, which you can direct either in the answer in the area of discipline, which we discussed yesterday, or in the area of preparing young people for marriage, which we want to discuss today. Preparing young people for marriage is a lot like walking a tightrope. It's a lot easier to fall off than it is to stay on. But there's one significant difference. If you fall off a tightrope, you can always get back on and try again. But in rearing children, you don't get a second chance. You don't get a trial run. You don't get an opportunity to go over the same journey again. Utopian systems of marriage make one fundamental blunder, and that is failing to recognize that marriage is developed in infancy. And unfortunately, most of us do not get sensitized enough until it's too late. Let's see if we can give you a little perspective. In terms of preparing a young person for marriage, there are two primary divisions to a young person's life. There's, first of all, the children's division, which goes from approximately 0 through 11 or 12, or the beginning of puberty. And there is, secondly, the period of adolescence, which in terms of our objective here goes from 12, or the beginning of puberty, to marriage. Now, the most determinative period involves the first 12 years of a child's life. And during this period of time, you communicate primarily to a child through three means. You communicate, first of all, and most importantly, through your attitude. Not by what you say, but by how you feel. See, most of us don't fail in the area of telling our children the right thing. But we communicate negative attitudes. We're going to talk more about this in just a few moments. But to me, this is becoming higher on my priority list every year. And I'd like to say something in passing. Perhaps we can develop it more tonight, depending on our time. But one of my great concerns with evangelicals is that most of them are working too hard at this job of parenthood. With the result that they're really uptight in the process. I have four children, and my wife and I were just discussing that if I had to catalog them, I would say that the older two tend to be more insecure, and the younger two to be the most secure. And when you ask me why, I will tell you it was about at the beginning of our third child that we started to get the picture. And we began to relax. And we began to enjoy it. Well, you know, when that first child arrives, oh boy, there he is, there she is, man, we gotta do it. Oh, we can't make a mistake. The truth of the matter is, man, you shoot yourself right out of the saddle in the process with all of your high intentions. If I could ever get a person to relax before the first child ever arrived, just to be determined, friend, I've got to trust God, and God, if you don't come through, I've had it. And you would create the most healthy, normal, relaxed atmosphere in which to bring up your children. But you see, the average woman, for example, so uptight with respect to, for example, her housekeeping. Ooh, it's all got to be in place. And the Wedgwood and all of the rest of the junk.
Man, it's so very important. It's got to be clean, immaculate, and the kid walks through with a dirty... Ooh, hold it.
And then about the time when you've done most of the damage, you come to the conclusion that there's something much more important than your furniture and the clean floors and all of the rest of the stuff that was so very high on your priority list to begin with. Which leads me to the second thing. And that is, you communicate primarily in terms of relationships.
That's why I say your relationships with your children are much more important than your reputation. But what you're most hung up on is your reputation. What in the world will people think?
So we beat the kid, stuff him in the closet, do anything else that's necessary because the company's coming. And we're so busy. Get out of here, kid. I just don't have time. I got company coming. And we want to lead some of these people to Jesus Christ. And the reason you laugh so much is, friend, I'm coming pretty close to home now. You find it very easy to identify with it. Relationships are much more important than almost anything else in the world. And basically, you have 12 years in which to build a relationship with your child. That's it. I'm not suggesting you cannot build relationships after that. I am saying these are the most determinative years in the bridge-building process. Now, the third way by which you communicate is through your example. Again, not what you say, but what you do. And I think one of the great problems, particularly with early marriages, is that most couples are so hung up with their own personal problems as a couple that they foist all of these problems on the child during the most impressionable period of the child's life. Whereas, had they postponed their marriage and worked out some of their own personal problems and their relationship with each other, so that when the child was born, they really had an example, if in no other way than just in a relationship that they sustained between each other. See, they'd have it made. Now, what you do during these 12 years will largely determine what happens during these 10, 12 years. Because you see, this is the blackout period. And that's not negative, that's positive. That's very, very important. Because what you were trying to do is to develop a child from complete dependence to complete independent. And that's a process. It doesn't develop overnight. And many people make all of the decisions for their children, do all of these things that they ought to be feeding to their child, with the result that someday they push them out the front door and say, okay, make it on your own. And the truth of the matter is, he's totally inequipped for it. But he goes through this period of time in order to reach that position of independence, when nobody knows less than my parents. They are wonderful people, but... And we'll ask you, what's it like to live on the ark, Dad? That's a very necessary period. And if a child does not go through that period, then he will carry that over into his adult life. And our communities are covered with people who are still in the process at 40 of working out their adolescence. It's very important that a child can make independent decisions, even though they are contrary to yours. And the attitudes that you have inculcated and the relationships that you have built and the example you have set will determine whether he is free to come to you during this period of time. Or whether, for all practical purposes, this is a closed door to him. Now, I'm not saying that this is not a very significant period. As a matter of fact, it is an extremely significant period.
But this is the period of time when your ministry is mostly supportive. And when you thank God, for example, for anything outside of your home, which is in league with your home, such as a youth director in a local church, or a navigator that takes your kid and builds a strong friendship with them, communicates to them the same thing that you're trying to communicate with them. Because this is very crucial. Now, let's suppose that you have an individual with whom you're working who doesn't come to know Jesus Christ as his Savior till now here. Well, he says, well, man, he's blown it all. Not really. Because what this kid is looking for, having had, let's say, 12 or 14 years of exposure, and now you profess to know Jesus Christ as Savior, is what difference does this make in your life? And when he discovers that when Jesus Christ comes into human experience, that that person changes, then that is the greatest testimony to him of what Jesus Christ can do in his own life during a period of drastic change. So it's not completely lost. I think the more serious penalty is the person who has known Jesus Christ all during these 12 years and has shot himself out of the saddle. Because for all practical purposes, for 12 years, he may be telling the kid that Jesus Christ really makes very little difference, except external. And as I mentioned last night, and I hope you caught the implication of what I said when I said, I would rather see you honestly inconsistent than dishonestly consistent. Because he will overlook your imperfections, but he will not overlook your hypocrisy. He deplores a phony. And this is what you are trying to avoid. Now, let's see if we can share a couple principles with you that'll get us started in the process. Number one, develop a warm but not a smothering relationship with both parents. Develop a warm but not a smothering relationship with both parents. If you haven't been awake up to this point, come alive. Because I want to share something with you from which I hope you never recover. It may make the most significant difference in the development of your children of anything that I will have to say. Here we have a man, and we have a woman, brought together in Jesus Christ in marriage. And let's say that God gives to this marriage two children. He gives a boy, and he gives a girl, a rich man's family. When you have two boys and two girls, you are doubly rich. Now, it is most important, and we have done this for years, that this boy establish a very strong relationship with his father. Because it is from this father that he gets an idea of what a man should be like, of what it means to be a husband. You see, how this man relates to this woman will determine how this boy relates to the opposite sex. If this man is a beast with this woman, then he's developing a first-class pervert, no matter what he tells him. The information is absolutely irrelevant. The modeling is most essential. If, conversely, he is a very thoughtful, considerate, loving man to this woman, then he is developing the most balanced, normal, healthy, perfect mate for someone to marry. Now, what we have also learned is not only is it important from this boy to relate to this father, but it is just as important for this boy to learn to relate, but not to over-relate to this mother. Because it is from this mother that he gets an idea of what a woman is like. of what a mother is like, of what a wife is like. And you will have said to you on some occasion, I hope, by your son, Dad, think there are any girls left like Mom around? And when your boy says that to you, you have then received the highest compliment you will ever get in your life. And you will know that you've come through loud and clear to him. Very, very common for a boy, particularly reared in a normal home, to look for a woman who is very, very largely like his mother. If that mother is a dominant, aggressive, controlling type of person, the interesting thing is he will become very weak, dependent, and he will invariably look for a woman who is just like his mother as his marriage partner. Now, we also know that it's very important for this girl to establish a strong relationship with her mother, because it is from her mother that she gets the idea of what it means to be female, what it means to be a mother and a wife, etc. Now, let's suppose this woman has what we call a feminine protest. She hates the fact that she's a woman. The greatest curse in her life was the day that she was born a woman. And every time she has a period, everything comes unglued in the house. We all hit the fan, everybody goes under the rocks, all things stop, meals are not served. The curse is now hit. Then the possibilities of that woman developing a first-class pervert, though she never said one word to her negatively about sex education, are absolutely classic. This girl will probably grow up hating the fact that she is also a woman. But this girl must learn also to relate, but not to over-relate, to her father. Because it is from her father that she gets the idea of what a man is like, of what kind of a person she wants to marry. This is the reason why my suggestion to you would be that in your home life, if you have a boy and a girl, that you as a father and you as a mother ought to spend a concerted period of time every week alone with that child. My wife and I made the goal early in our marriage, and it's the one thing for which we have no regrets, though I assure you there were many times when it broke down. We made the pact that we would spend 1 hour alone every week with each of our children, usually in activities dictated by the child. We happen to have two of each, and of course as the children began to grow up, then I would take my girls out for a date. And I let them know beforehand, we're going to have a date together. Boy, it's a hose and heels deal. And man, they get all fixed up and they drop by the florist and pick up a 50-cent corsage. And we take off out the front door and go over to a favorite tea room where they love to eat. We go window shopping. I got one girl on each arm. All the time they are spending with me, they are determining what it means to be a man. They are determining what kind of a man I want to marry. They are determining what does it mean to be a father and a husband. And as I shared with some of you, I have the greatest thrill. I still break out sort of in cold sweat every time I watch my two boys take my wife out. It just does something to me. They drive by now, so they chauffeur her around and open a car door and take her out for the date. It's the biggest deal in all the world as she goes down to walk one of them on either side. Now let me show you what happens when you don't do this. The greatest perversion on the American scene today is homosexuality. We are now up to 6 out of every 100 in the American population. Southern California, 24 out of every 100. And it's the fastest growing perversion in our society. We have some very significant studies that have been done in this area, particularly one that has been a longitudinal study. I want to share with you the results because they are very remarkable from a biblical point of view. Out of 200 and some homosexuals in the study, both male and female, this is their conclusion. A homosexual is always the product of one of two things. Number one, he has a hostile, passive, detached father. And or a dominant, smothering, aggressive mother. If you ever put the two together, the combination is absolutely lethal. And usually, they go together. Because if you have a very weak, passive father, you usually have a mother who thinks that it's her responsibility to become dominant, to take over the male leadership, and she becomes aggressive and very smothering. And the interesting thing is, in all of my exposure to this, I have never yet found an exception. You either have one or both in a family. Now stop for a minute and think through the implications. You know what this is saying? This is saying these are exactly the opposite of the biblical roles for a man and a woman. In other words, whenever you reverse the biblical role of a man and a woman, your possibilities of developing a homosexual are absolutely fantastic. Now, what you think I'm talking about is people who were reared in non-Christian homes. But that's not true. There are as many homosexuals developed in Christian homes as there are in pagan homes. And the interesting thing is that often they are developed by the most sincere people in all the world, particularly women. I have women who just can't understand. I had a woman come to see me some time ago. I had seen her boy, so I knew he was infected with the problem. He came home one night with a pair of silk stockings hanging out his back pocket, still had the rouge, the lipstick, because he serves as the feminine part in a homosexual relationship. His father's a guy about 6'3" tall, just a perfect specimen of humanity, but a perfectly passive individual. Tremendous baseball star, played for the professional leagues, but out to lunch in his home. And I don't know what this does to you, but I'm still viscerated by that. We are facing this, my friends, I tell you this honestly and frankly in order for you to get the picture. We are facing this all the time in a seminary. And periodically we have to clean out just the core that developed. And I will take you to any Christian organization and I will show you exactly the same thing. And they always come, ladies and gentlemen, from a home where this kid has no pattern. He has no model. And so he overrelates to his mother. This girl has no pattern. She doesn't want to be like her. She hates her mother. So she overattaches herself to him. You show me a guy who's so proud of his father, man, I want to be just like my dad. And you say, how about mom? Oh, man, boy, I sure hope I can find a girl like her around. Or you find a girl who's so proud of her mother, good night. It's just thrilling to know that I have a mother. She's so proud to introduce her. And her father, boy, he's the greatest. That's the kind of guy I want for my life. There's one other dimension that's very important here, and that's this dimension right here. Because oftentimes this gets very dynamic. They fight like crazy. Don't they? And that's wonderful. Because that's a part of the process of preparing them for marriage. Don't laugh so hard, my friend. I got girls who've never fought with anybody. So when they get married, they got a tremendous object. Especially somebody of the opposite sex. They're really still working out a lot of the things that are developed in a very normal home relationship. The dear girl who's overly protective and scared to death that somebody's ever going to touch her body, who's been reared in a home with four boys where they wrestled with her, you know, where they ran into the bathroom one day when she forgot to lock the door, and all of the other normal things that happen in anybody's home life, is a person who grows up so disgustingly normal it's refreshing. But as far as I am concerned, this is one of the major reasons why I think the most exciting dimensions in home life come in that what I call the polishing machine. Did you ever take stones and throw them into a little polishing machine and go around like this and they come out and you look, whoa, that's pretty, put in some more. That's exactly what happened. They knock all the rough edges off, they get smooth as all get. And they know how to relate to the opposite sex. And if you have a choice, of course, obviously, get one of each, preferably two. If you were so endowed, try three of each. Now, any questions about this, first of all, before we go on, because I want you to see something that to me is basic through the whole process of preparing a person for marriage. You understand what we're talking about? Yes, Walt. He overrelates to his daughter, Walt, primarily by, number one, spending too much time with her, let's say to the exclusion particularly of his boy, by, number two, developing an inordinate type of affection with her, rather than a natural, normal type of relationship that he would have. For example, we have a girl, or had a girl at the seminary, who had a tremendous problem relating to her father for this very reason. Father's an outstanding Christian leader. But this was his only girl. He had four boys and one girl. And she was the last child born. You see, and it's almost a built-in type of situation where he just spent all of his time with her, man's the only girl I'm ever going to have. Every time he went out, he'd pick her up while the four guys would stand looking through the plate glass window. The interesting thing is, in this family, two of them are now homosexual. And I talked to one in a counseling situation, and he said to me, I'd give my right arm. Perhaps I'd give my right arm if my father had taken me. In fact, I felt so badly of it, I'd give anything if I could have been a girl. And he fulfills a feminine role in a homosexual relationship. So I'm just dying to get that kind of attention that my sister got. But you see, a normal relationship where not only does that girl relate to her father, but by the same token, normally relates to her mother, then you get this balancing factor. And as we're going to see later, this also involves the whole process, for example, of pushing your girl out. The man will do this by making all of his decisions for his girl because he wants to protect her. I love her. So I don't want her to make a mistake. I don't want her to do anything wrong. I don't want her to get exposed to anything. So I protect her. You build all of these fences around her until finally the blast. Yes,
Bob? Is there any particular danger? What does a one-child family...
Yes, Bob. What does he miss?
What is he missing? Is there a danger?
Well, there is a danger. Of course, you know, you always have the danger of the spoiling type of process, the fact that you've only got one, consequently you pour all your eggs in one into one basket. The other danger is that often he thinks that all of life revolves around him. He tends to become a self-centered person rather than an other-centered person, which he's not allowed to be when he's in a home where there are other people who are competing against him. Now, the interesting thing that happens, for example, I happen to be in this type of situation. Of course, it was a broken home. It was a blessing that I was the only one. But the one thing my grandmother did, and I didn't know why or all the understanding behind it, was we always had boys in our home. We always had kids in our home, with the result that that provided an awful lot of the mix, which my own family didn't provide. So this can be obviated. But your danger often is that if you have only one child, particularly this woman tends to over-identify with him because that's my boy. It's the only child. It's
the Isaac, the one whom thou lovest. Yes?
Can you make some comments on if a daughter doesn't get enough attention from the father for approval?
Yes, I'd say to me the most important thing is for you not, I'm talking about this person, I'm talking about with them. He'll be very careful with these questions. You people fire at me, I'll be tried for blackmail and incriminating evidence and everything else. With this type of individual, the first thing I say to her is, "What, madam, do not over-relate to your child because your father, your husband, does not give him or her attention. Don't try to take his place. Because you see, it's the compensating factor that pushes you over."
I was wondering how it affects the dog.
You mean if this woman over relates to this?
If the daughter does not get
the attention
or affection from the father, how does it affect the daughter?
Well, it tends to affect the daughter in the sense that it does not give her the adequate model that she really needs for her marriage. Now, the interesting thing is that quite often this girl works it out because she will find models elsewhere. For instance, it's very common among teenagers to spend more time in somebody else's home than in your own. And when this happens, I begin to say, you ever ask yourself what's happening? It could be good, but it could be saying something terrible to me, and that is that really my kid may be finding more of a model down the street in somebody else's home than they're finding in my own, and the result is they're spending a lot of time. It concerns me greatly that my children would not want to come. Conversely, it never concerns me that my home is covered over with people as it has been for so many years. Lauren and I were talking today, he was showing me his study in his home. And I said, "Man, friend, you got me green with envy. I never had this privilege, and I had to discipline myself to learn how to study in the midst of the living room with this Grand Central traffic going in and out. But you know, it's the most wonderful thing in all of the world as far as my kids are concerned." And I would always say to them, "What, you want to have some kids over? Sure, come on over, hang out, man. This is the local hangout in the community." You see, the average person hits the fan. I don't have a very attractive home. My furniture is beat up. It's wonderful beat up. In fact, I can go home, you know, my wife can go home tomorrow, me next week, and we can look at all the broken threads. It's tremendous, because each one has another story with it. But you see, this is where I say your reputation is worthless. Your responsibility is crucial. I can always get a new set of furniture, but I can't get a new set of kids.
But just for the record, our daughter gets...
I know you're not... And that's why I said, when you said it, and I said you, because I'm always trying to personalize this type of thing. Doesn't that relieve you greatly, buddy? Any other? Somebody else had a question here. Yeah, right.
This being away from home like this, is this true in the young children below, you know, 6, 12?
Oh, you mean, does this have a great effect upon
them? No. If your children, you said if your children were gone away from your home all the time, you'd begin to wonder, well, now, is this true in a little child?
Not as much, for the simple reason that quite often this is a kid that's just in the process, particularly if he's very creative, very investigative, very inquisitive. He's always running around, you know, finding what's in everybody else's yard, and garbage pail, and, you know, pulling all the stuff out and bringing it home. Got a colleague who has a kid like his. I love this kid like crazy. He's my favorite. Every time I go over there, I say, "What else did you pick up?" This kid goes all up and down the garbage cans, you know, and pulls out all this stuff and brings it home. He got a first-class junk shop out there. Terrific stuff. He picks up. No, this is a different type of thing. Now, there is another thing that latches onto this that I thought you were asking, and let's bring it up. And that is the person says, "But what about, let's say, a father who travels, etc." Some very interesting studies have been done on this, and sometimes some of the best fathers are traveling salesmen. You know why? It isn't the fact that you are absent from home. In fact, I have to tell some parents to take off away from their home. They're such a poor influence on their children. See, it isn't the amount of time you spend, it's the quality of the relationship. And this guy, you know, travels a great deal, but man, when he comes home, oh boy, this is the greatest thing in all the world. Because he spends a lot of time. He wants to spend time. He chooses to spend time. And that's what says something to a kid. Whereas, you know, you go home and say, "Well, I should spend more time with my kids." Okay, kids, come on, let's go now. Hurry up, and I don't have a lot of time to horse around. Hendrick says I'm supposed to play with you. Throw the ball clean through him. You know where you might as well be? Anywhere in the world except playing ball with him. You'd be much rather to say, "Hey, buddy, I'd like to take 5 minutes to spend ball with you. I don't know anything I'd rather do." And you just lose yourself in the thing. And then say, man, friend, I got to go hit the trail. And the kid says, boy, great. We'll take it up tomorrow. There's one other thing I wanted to add, because this is something I'm coming into more and more. And that is, people have said to me, for example, but what about this business of when should you spend this time? The interesting thing is, I am finding that a child adapts more to your absence in the first 12 years than he does as an adolescent in our culture. In our culture, your presence with an adolescent is very, very crucial, even though he'll tell you to drop dead. Now, that's hard to believe, so you have to take that by faith. All right, let me give you a second one. Help your child develop an appreciation for his own sex and a respect for the opposite sex. Help him develop an appreciation for his own sex and a respect for the opposite sex. Now, it is amazing how you communicate negatively in this area. Every now and then I'm in the home and I will hear a woman say to a child when something happens, well, all men are like that. Oh, man, my friend, that's worse than the rattler bite. See, you are poisoning a child with respect to men because of the action of one individual. You know who's the favorite culprit on this? And friend, I have open season for them. Preachers who make snide remarks about women. Now, you just listen. You may not have been sensitive about it. But you know, come to Mary. Well, there's Mary crying just like a woman. Ha, ha, ha. And the interesting thing is, you would be amazed how much you communicate to a person in that. In fact, most men tip their hand. When I find a man who talks this way about a woman, he's telling me more about himself than he really wants to tell me. He's telling me that he really has an awful lot of feminine protest. And you have to be very careful what you say. This is one reason why I would say never. You may have to say something very pointed, very critical to your partner, but never say that in the presence of your children. Because they tend to draw false generalizations from this. The thing you ought to do is to magnify your mate. You know what I say to my boys frequently, and my, as you know from any exposure to my wife, boy, this is the easiest assignment in all the world. I just love to go out with my guys and we play ball and we're sitting down under a tree resting and we start shooting a breeze and we get off on all kinds of subjects. And I look them straight in the eye and say, boy, man, greatest claim to fame we have in Hendrick's household is that mom is our mother. He comes right up out of the chair. Or let me give you another illustration. I'm glad she's not here so I won't embarrass her. You don't tell her that I told you this. Promise? I was up in Wheaton College speaking. And I was staying at the dormitory. And my girl is attending there. My boy is in Moody in Chicago, so he came out. We had a wonderful time of fellowship. We were really planning what was coming off this summer, and kids were telling me some of the things they were interested in getting involved in and so forth. And we had a wonderful time of prayer together. And then we were sort of sitting around shooting the breeze, and all of a sudden Bev said, you know, Dad, it's an amazing thing. But I've been doing a lot of thinking lately as to why I don't have negative attitudes toward the fact that you traveled so much. She said, I got a lot of kids here, even in the house where I live, a lot of kids that I've met whose fathers are missionaries and preachers and what have you. And she said, frankly, boy, they have sad attitudes. And she said, I've been trying to think why. And Bob chimed in. He said, Bev, I get the answer. He said, the answer is mom. He said, I never once ever remember my mother saying anything negative about the fact that you were traveling. Beth says, you know, I hadn't thought of it. But she said, I remember we would take you to the airport and on our way home, Mom would say to us, boy, isn't it wonderful? God has given us the privilege of sharing our Father with other people.
Now try that on for size negatively. Just for a minute. To get the point I'm trying to make. Let's suppose you drop him off at the airport. And the moment he goes out, you say, "Well, kids, let's go home. Here we are again." Now, you don't even have to say that in words, but if that ever comes through to a kid, see, it comes through loud and clear. And this is my own personal viewpoint, does not necessarily represent the viewpoint of the management of this program, so I'll bear all responsibility for it, but this is one reason why I, as a man, would never let my son touch a woman. I would beat him to a pulp. And I mean that. He will never forget laying a hand on a woman. To me, there is nothing lower in my book than a guy who will touch a woman. I got plenty of men I'd be glad to let you try on for size if you really want to get some pugilistic tendencies out of you. But there's something to me that is lower than low. And what it is that I am communicating to my child that a woman is a person you respect so much that even if she slapped you all over the place, you'd look her straight in the eye and walk away. Now, I think this type of attitude is something that you communicate in very subtle nuances. But some of you who have small children have some of the choicest opportunities, because someday you ought to pick up that little girl that, you know, can hardly talk yet. Would you look her straight in the eye and say, "Man, Mommy's so proud of you. You're a girl. Just think of it. God hand-tooled you for our family as a girl. Isn't it a wonderful thing to be a girl?" Rather than thinking, you know, "Well, here we are, second-class citizens. We're submissive. Well, we better not get off on that. We'll be here all day. Here's a third one I want you to try on for size."
House clean your attitude. If I had no other reason in all the world for daily exposure to the scriptures, this would be it. Just to keep my attitude positive. You see, just in the process of living, you develop negative attitude. The longer you live, if you're not careful, the more negative they become. Because the more you discover what people are really like. You find this in business? You know, I mean, it's incredible that this guy tells you this when you know and he knows it's a bold-faced lie looking you straight in the eye. And you know, you do all these things for these people, and then all the time they're just cutting the ground right out from under you. You know, if you're not careful, the older you get, the more bitter you become. And what you need is a constant housekeeping. And I would say that's particularly true for both a man and a woman, but for different reasons. The average woman spends so much time in the home that her danger is that she becomes negative in her attitudes towards home. And a man spends so much time on the outside that he tends to become negative toward the outside. But his problem is he spills it over into his family. Let me give you an illustration. One of my problems is that I know too much. It is absolutely incredible what's been poured into these ears concerning people. And you know what the danger is? The danger is I can come home and sit down, you know, and you walk in, man, I got all of this garbage poured in there all day long. And you come and you sit down and say, "Okay, come on, sit down, let's get this show on the road." And you know what I'm doing? I am penalizing my family for my involvement in my ministry or in your business or what have you. This is the reason why I have a very interesting point in Dallas. Some of you are from Dallas, and there's an R.L. Thornton Expressway. And it passes the Trinity River over here in East Dallas. And the seminary is down here, and my home is out here, and they drive down here to go to cemetery, and down here to go home. So when I'm down here, boy, I got all kinds of problems. You wouldn't believe the stuff that comes in my correspondence. You wouldn't believe the stuff that walks into my office, and they dump all this stuff. All day long this goes on. And I get this tremendous collection of people's problems and needs and criticisms, and this thing's falling apart and the rest of it. And then I got to drive home. You know what I discovered? I discovered very early in the game that it was very easy for me to poison my children with this kind of venom. So I developed a point of no return, and that's it. I think about all my problems with my students, problems with the alumni, faculty, you name it. All the way out here till I get to here. And I drop it all right on the freeway. There's a law against it, but I do it all the time. I drop the whole cotton picking thing right out the window. And just on the side. So when I go home, boy, I don't bring any of this garbage into here. Next day I drive back, guess where it is? You know? Yeah, it's crossed over. Waving like crazy for me to pick it up. Never has missed me. It's all there to pick up, take back, carry on for the next day. The problem is the danger of dumping it here. You can do this with your business problems, your professional problems, your ministry. And the interesting thing is that is exactly why you will get a kid reared in a minister's home or in a NAV rep's home or in a doctor's home or anybody else's kind of home, who when you ask him, son, what do you want to be? I don't know what I want to be, but I'll tell you one thing I don't want to be. And to me, that's the saddest thing in all of the world. To think that I should rear two boys, for example, who would think that the greatest penalty of life would be to go into the ministry. All because I poisoned them and wrote. You know, I can tell them things about my students. I can tell them things about my colleagues. I can tell them things of what's going on in the Christian world that could just flat wipe them out. And boy, this is a discipline, my friend. This is a tremendous discipline. And this is why I think rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice and remember the circumstances in prison. Now, I really can't teach you very much of this. If you really want to learn this, you talk to my wife. She has taught me every single thing I know, basically, in this area. She knows far more than I ever thought of knowing. But she has done worlds to me as a person. And my friend, if you're working as a partnership, you need to help each other like this in the area of strengths and weaknesses. Here's another one. Oh, yes. I love this one. Don't be afraid to express your love to your partner before your children. Greatest thing you can do for your son is to love your son's mother. And don't evaluate this on the basis of your children's evaluation, especially if they're teenagers. Because every time you embrace that, oh no, here we go again. I was in the middle of an embrace with my wife in the living room, and Bill came plowing through the front door with his buddy down the street, and then he said, oh, good night, we're going to have to wait a minute. This kid says, why, what's the matter? Oh, my parents are in there smooching. He says, let's go in. I said, this stuff goes on all the time around our home. This little kid looks him straight in the eye and says, boy, Bill, it must be wonderful to have a father that loves your mother. He said, I don't even know who my father is. Every night we got a different jerk in this house. Must be wonderful to have a father that loves your mother like that. And to a little kid that grows up and tends to take this for granted, my friend, he gets something shoved down the center of his throat he'll never forget. I think the saddest story I ever get in my office is the story I get all too frequently of kids, many of whom came out of Christian homes, who will say to me, as a girl said to me not long ago, Prof, I can never remember once in all my life my father expressing his love to my mother publicly.
That's the saddest heritage you can possibly give your child. Conversely, the greatest heritage you can give is two people who are hopelessly and unashamedly in love with each other. And a kid grows up in the midst of this, and this is the most exciting, secure thing in all of the world. Here's another one. Help your child, encourage him to make his own decisions. Now, this is real hard to come by because we are so prone to make all of the decisions for our children. But make sure of one thing, and that is there are going to be casualties in the process. But there's something worse than a casualty, and that's not having one. My wife and I, when we were married, got the most lovely set of china you have ever seen. It was absolutely exquisite. Very expensive. Given to us by a couple who loved us for Christ's sake and built so much into our life as a couple and as individual. And out of their love, gave us this very expensive, lovely set of china. And in the process of time, we got four children and we had to make a decision. And the decision was, will we keep the china intact and have children who grow up without knowing how to wash and dry dishes, or will we have children who grow up knowing how to wash and dry dishes, and in the process, you know, you might lose a cup or two. Well, if you want to know what route we took, you come down to my home in Dallas, and when you look into the china closet and see that remaining cup, then you will know. But I constantly run into people who are more concerned about their Wedgwood than they are about the maturity of their children. You know what I like to do to them someday? I like to walk right into the middle of their home and pull a piece of Wedgwood right out of the middle of the closet and throw it on the floor and dash it in pieces and have them crawl all over me and nail me to the wall. And then when I got all of the stuff out, then I'd sit down and say, now let me share with you a few stories as to what is really important in your home. I want to get you out of the junk business and into the business of developing children. One reason for my money, better homes and gardens and the rest of that stuff would be better if it never hit the American scene. Because you get this false, aseptic, artificial atmosphere in terms of a home. Best homes in all the world are homes that look like they've been lived in. Not homes where you're scared to sit down for fear something's going to break. Well, here's another suggestion I would give to you. And that is spend time with your children doing the things they enjoy. Study taken a few years ago here in the United States said the average time the American father spends alone with his child, his boy, every week is 7.5 minutes. And as I mentioned a moment ago, it's not the amount, it's the quality. It's what you do when you have time. And I would say if I had no other route to take or to advocate to you, I would encourage you to intensify your interpersonal relations with your children. An interesting experience not too long ago. We have a man in our community who was with his company, number one or two man. He happens to be, I think, an insurance selling something anyway. And I mean, he's a winner. Boy, he's a salesman for the word go. Boy, he's got it. He's on top of it. But he lost his two girls en route. And so he came to see me. And we got talking. I said, how much time do you spend with your girl? Well, he said, I guess I don't spend very much time. But he said, I feel that's
mother's task primarily. So, well, I got news for you, my friend. That's really your task just as well. In fact, it's very important that your girls learn how to relate to you. I said, you're a real good salesman. Tell me how you learned to sell. He said, I learned that the most effective tool in selling is a table. He said, I never eat a meal by myself. I take a client out to dinner. I meet him for breakfast. We invite him over to our home for dinner. I said, let me ask you, when's the last time you took your two most important clients out to lunch? And you know, he said to me, man, it was just as if somebody took the curtains and parted them like that. See, here are my most important clients in all of the world. But I never take them out to lunch. Never spend any time with them. And I think that this is a subtle type of thing that, you know, creeps up on you, on the inside. And that is, we spend a lot of time with very significant people, but the most significant people we're often too busy for. And I think it's through these personal, intensified personal relations that you communicate your convictions to a child. And it's very important that you know what you stand for and what you believe for. That's especially true in our culture. It doesn't make as much difference that your convictions are contrary to the convictions of your child as much as it does that you are communicating your convictions, that your child knows exactly what you believe and why. And I believe this is largely communicated through a process of interpersonal relations. In other words, it's caught, in my judgment, more than it is taught. Now, let's all throw it open for some questions. I've yakked long enough on this. Okay, Walt?
Yes, we live also in an age where our advertisement and news media and so forth accentuate the importance of our children. For example, American Airlines will show an ad of a child just returning from the Bahamas or someplace like this. And in essence, what they're saying, wouldn't it be great if you'd go and hop for $5,000 so that your son could have that kind of a trip? And I could see that. And they think to themselves, well, yeah, my dad and mom really ought to consider me to be the most important thing, and in fact go and hop $5,000 for me. How do you balance this with what we've been talking about here?
Well, I balance it, first of all, because I think the motivation is vastly different. The motivation of American Airlines or any other company is not primarily your family. It's the stock of the company. It's filling seats. And whatever will sell that to you is a good thing. And they are committed to selling the youth on the concept. The whole basis of the youth plan and the rest of it is to get a kid infected with flying by air so that it'll never go by ground again. And the highest incidence of college students' transportation is by air as a result of this type of a program. I think what I'm trying to do is to develop an altogether different motivation, that I do what I do with him and spend the time that I spend with him and go on a vacation with him and the rest of them, not because it's primarily advantageous to me, but because I'm interested in him as a person. In other words, to me, there's a deeper level of communication that comes through to the kid. And I saw it particularly, I would say, because I've asked my children over and over again, just for my information as well as instruction, what is it that you remember most about your childhood? And they remember most our family vacations, because they were fun times. They were times when Dad was with us, and when we pulled off the road, you know, because we couldn't drive any further from laughing so hard. And Pop horsing around, you know, singing the songs, and the rest of it.